Hello and welcome to Experience Austin Peay, the podcast dedicated to highlighting why this is the premier university in the region. I'm Charles Booth, Director of Communication, and this is our final episode of our inaugural season, Forgotten Tennessee. And today we're excited to have Dr. Dwayne Estes with us. Dr. Estes is a professor of biology here, and he's also the executive director of the Southeastern Grasslands Institute, which really recently celebrated its fifth anniversary. And since this is Forgotten Tennessee, we're going to talk a little bit today about the Forgotten Walker Smith Expedition of 1779, which he's been researching, and I don't really know anything about.
Yeah, it's it's kind of funny because the Walker Smith Expedition of 1779 was the attempt by the governor of Virginia and the governor of North Carolina at the time, because in those days, what is now Kentucky was part of Virginia, and what is now Tennessee was part of North Carolina. We had not each achieved statehood, right? And so a lot of your listeners may be wondering, why is a professor of biology coming on to talk about a state line boundary survey that clearly falls within the realm of American history,
right,
or cartography, you know, but not biology? What's up with that?
Right, exactly.
So it, you know, it's kind of a, it is a forgotten story, but it has amazing implications. Many people don't realize it, but when you look at a map and you see the present day boundary between Tennessee and Kentucky, many people probably wondered, you know, why is it when you trace the northern boundary and you get to land between the lakes, the boundary line goes up, over, down, and then over to the Mississippi River?
Yeah, I always wondered about that.
Well, I'm going to tell you why, and it relates. But it also relates in great part to the work that we do as the Southeastern Grasslands Institute is connected to the Center of Excellence for Field Biology in the Department of Biology to conserve and research the grasslands of Montgomery County today and of Tennessee and Kentucky. So, when you're ready, Charles, I'll just kind of tell you that story of the Walker Smith Expedition.
Yeah, I'd love that, because I think before I met you years ago, I never knew about grasslands in this area. And I think you've kind of educated me. And so it's exciting to talk to you. So, yeah, please go on about the expedition.
Okay, I'm going to do my best to recount it. And for the listeners, if you Google the Walker Smith Expedition, there are original documents out there that you can find to learn more about it. But essentially, the governor of North Carolina and the governor of Virginia, and this would have been in the year 1779, commissioned two teams of surveyors to meet together at what is currently the present-day boundary of where North Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee come together. So they met, agreed to meet at a place called Steep Rock Creek, which is up in the extreme northeastern corner of modern-day Johnson County, Tennessee, in the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And the reason they met there was that the prior surveyors who had surveyed what is now the North Carolina and Virginia state line, they originally had started that survey work all the way from the Atlantic coast in like the 1740s, back in in colonial days, prior to the founding of our nation. And that work was surveyed as far west as Steep Rock Creek, where our story is going to begin today.
Okay.
There had not been at that point a survey continuing west all the way to the Mississippi River. And so in the era and in the sort of name of westward expansion, you got to keep in mind that the Revolutionary War was sort of ongoing. We had just declared independence from Great Britain. And so there was interest on behalf of the American colonies to push westward to the Mississippi River. There had been, recent, in the former two or three decades, battles with France to control all of Eastern North America,
right.
Between Great Britain and France. And so all these things sort of paved the way then for the growth of the American colonies. And so we begin to see a lot of land speculation, a lot of exploration. Naturalists are hired to go and hike through and wander through the backcountry to explore the land for its resources, looking for mineral deposits, looking for timber resources, you know, where are places that people could go settle? So to get ahead of all that land speculation, and, you know, and a lot of the forefathers of our country, like George Washington, he was interested in land speculating. You know, he and his contemporaries formed what they called land companies. And so the Ohio Land Company, for example, was a group of very wealthy investors that were interested in surveying the state of Ohio and Indiana to get ahead of all the settlers that they saw that would be going to those places.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, you know, if they owned that land and controlled that land and could sort of control the settlement of that land, then they stood to gain, you know, become very, very wealthy.
Right. Good business sense to kind of do this.
Yeah. So for Tennessee, it was kind of the same thing. And for Virginia, for North Carolina, Virginia, it was the same thing. They saw a lot of their settlers who lived east of the Blue Ridge Mountains increasingly wanting to move west of the mountains into what is modern day Kentucky and Tennessee. And so there became this need then to better establish political boundaries. So these two governors established two commission teams, and they agreed to meet at the head of Steep Rock Creek and to go west and to continue to survey the boundary line between these two states. Well, from the start, these two teams could not agree on a starting point. So the team from North Carolina says, no, we're too far south. You know, North Carolina's governor demands that we should be 3 miles farther north. Virginia's governor says, absolutely not. You know, their team says, no, absolutely not. We need to be 3 miles farther south, you know?
Right.
And the Virginia team was led by Dr. Thomas Walker, who was a really famous frontier surveyor, doctor, and he was also a mentor to President Thomas Jefferson and had befriended Jefferson's family. They lived in the same community. So Walker was this, you know, he was an avid hunter, a woodsman. He was well-trusted, and he was wealthy. He was often present at major treaties between, you know, the various Indian nations and the burgeoning American government, you know, as they were working on these land deals. He was really in the thick of everything.
That's amazing, yeah.
It's also Dr. Thomas Walker who's credited with naming the Cumberland River, which flows through Clarksville today.
Oh, really? Okay, wow. Yeah.
And the discovery of the Cumberland Gap. Both of those happened more or less on the same day, mm-hmm. about 29 years earlier in the year 1750, because it was back then that Walker had previously led a group of men through Cumberland Gap, and they crossed the Cumberland River, naming it for the Duke of Cumberland back in Great Britain.
Oh, okay. So that's where the name comes from.
Yeah. And so because of his being woods wise and being a renowned sort of gentleman of the day, he was then chosen to head up the Virginia component of this expedition. So they couldn't agree on anything. They decided then after about probably several days of effort to try to reconcile and start at a common point, they decided they couldn't start at a common point. So the North Carolina team goes 3 miles farther north on one mountain. The Virginia team goes 3 miles farther south on another mountain. And they basically then just sort of can't agree. So they start moving west.
Wow.
Surveying their own independent lines. Well, they do this. They go up and over mountain range after mountain range. They cross the Ridge and Valley of East Tennessee. And after like a month, and this is probably in the early winter month or late winter months, they finally get to where Cumberland Gap is now. And when you get to Cumberland Gap, you would encounter a massive wall of mountains. It's like 50 miles wide.
Wow.
And by that point, the North Carolina team is just fed up. And they write back to the governor of North Carolina and say, we quit. We're done. We're out.
Oh, wow. Just this has been a hard journey. And they're just,
The Virginia team won't work with us.
Wow.
They won't listen to us. We send a man over every few days to try to reconcile. We're just done. So they quit. They quit the whole expedition. They go home. The Virginia team now, led by Dr. Walker, and they get up to the top of these mountains that they just encountered as they're moving west, which is right at Cumberland Gap. And they're up on the top of the mountains, and they look west, and they see endless sea of mountaintops just out before their eyes. And all of a sudden, he almost had a mutiny on his hands. And this team is like, absolutely not. We are not going to go down one mountain and over another and another. There's like 50 that we can see. So the only way he could salvage his team was to say, wait. Let's just go down the mountain. We'll go through Cumberland Gap. We'll go up to the Cumberland River. And we're going to just bypass these mountains. We're going to go, we're going to float down the Cumberland River. And when the river intersects the modern day Tennessee-Kentucky line, then we'll get out and we'll proceed west again. So they said, okay, all right, you got a deal. We'll do that. So they go up and around, they go deep into Kentucky and they wind their way around and they come down to about where modern day Dale Hollow Lake is in Tennessee, where the Cumberland comes out of Kentucky. They get out and they proceed west again. Now, the important part here is they're taking measurements the whole way. You know, they're using what are called chains and poles, and they've got all these sort of old-timey compasses and archaic instrumentation. And they're taking notes, and they're talking about how many buffalo they're killing, how many elk they're harvesting. They're killing turkeys left and right. They're harvesting deer because you got to feed this team of men, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, as they get out in modern-day Clay County, just near Salina, Tennessee, moving west, and then at this point, they're still about 100 and 120 miles east of what is now Clarksville. At every single one-mile marker along the line, they're taking a data point. So the data point in those days was a tree. So when they get to, you know, mile number 178 or whatever their journey, I'm just making that up, they'd say, here's a white oak tree. And at this white oak, you know, we noticed three bison, we killed three deer, we killed three turkeys. Then they would go for another mile and they would mention the next tree. Another mile, they'd mention the next tree. Well, that worked really well when you're kind of in the heart of Appalachia, where it's a forested landscape. You got plenty of trees. But when they hit modern day Sumner County, Tennessee, after about sort of 40 miles after leaving the Cumberland River, they said their notes began to change. He said, now we encountered a series of briary sort of thickety type of hills, right? Mm-hmm. It's symbolic of landscape change. Things are opening up. There's more brush and scrub. But when they get to about where modern day Mitchellville, Tennessee is in northern Sumner County, right on the Kentucky line, this is about 50 miles east of Clarksville. They said, and now we entered the Barrens. And then there's a simple note. It says, we stayed within the Barrens for another 120 miles until we came within 3 miles of the Cumberland River. And what that insinuates then, Charles, is when they hit the edge of what they called the Barrens, which is this great, vast grassland, it was 120 miles wide. Wow. And they didn't take any more notes at each milepost that whole distance because of the lack of trees.
Lack of trees. Okay. So that's not, I grew up here. That's not what I, if I'm imagining back to that time period, I'm thinking a big forest is in this area, but it's, we've got a big barren grassland.
You got one of the largest grasslands in the eastern United States, and their survey notes record the presence of that grassland, which they called a barrens back then.
Wow. Yeah. That's just, it's when you first told me that a couple of years ago, I was like, I never had that idea that that's what this looked like. And then, I mean, how did they, you know, the trees eventually came up over the last 200 years or?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this was essentially an open tall grass prairie. You know, the grasses would have been anywhere from, you know, 2 feet to, you know, 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And the thing that would have maintained that, the Big Barrens, as it was called, that's the name that later in the 19th century and 20th century, people called that specific region the Big Barrens region. Mm-hmm. We sometimes today call it the Pennyroyal Plain. And you might even recognize those names on the modern landscape, like Pennyroyal State Forest, just up near Katy's, Kentucky, for example. But it was maintained by a combination of fire, which Native Americans would set fire every single year to burn off the prairie. Lightning caused fires. And then, of course, you had up until about in this region around Clarksville, we had buffalo, bison, until about the 1795 time period.
Oh, man.
So their grazing would have kept these open as well.
Oh, wow. So that's wild. So if I were, you know, in the hypothetical, go back in time, I could see buffalo, you know, all these sort of ecosystem that just doesn't exist here anymore.
It's a vanished ecosystem that mostly doesn't exist. What we still have are the remnants of it around. And, you know, for anybody who lives in Clarksville, this is kind of a, we think about forgotten landscapes or ecosystems, you know, forgotten landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just say we think about old times, an old tobacco barn, right? That kind of harkens back to maybe the 1950s, 1960s. An old log cabin, you know, makes people think about the Civil War days or something like that. These old stone walls you see around Nashville, think about, you know, the days of slavery and pre-Civil War era. But there are landscapes around, too, that if you know how to identify them, but that can take our memories back even farther, like into the 1700s or the 1600s. And I'll give you one clue that people in Clarksville hear very frequently, and they don't realize when they're hearing it, but they're hearing something that connects to this former prairie landscape. Have you ever been sitting around town, or I don't know exactly where you live, but I know for me, I lived for about 13 years on one of the suburbs on the north end of the city. And I'd be back out in my backyard playing with my kids or something. I would hear boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 right? That was about 15 miles to the west at Fort Campbell Army Base, where they were shooting these ordnances mm-hmm. in training practice, right? Firing at tanks and objects out in the middle of what they call the impact zone on the northwest side of base. Well, those that firing of those ordnances, that very moment was setting fire to the grasslands at Fort Campbell. And those fires would burn an area of about 25,000 acres. And still today, that's the biggest piece that's left of the Big Barrens. And those Walker Smith Party members, they walk right through Fort Campbell's impact zone in 1779. Oh, but today, wow. That little bit of land that's about 3.5 to 4 miles wide, right mm-hmm. up there on the northwest side of Fort Campbell Army Base, it still burns every year. It still looks almost exactly like it would have looked in 1779. And we can thank the U.S. Army for accidentally, if you will, protecting the last biggest component of that forgotten landscape. And it's right in northwestern Montgomery County, just 20 minutes from our offices at Austin Peay.
So you've been to this area? I mean, so I'm assuming it's...
Yeah, I took a trip out there just about 3 weeks ago. We were escorted by the Fort Campbell staff to go specifically look out into the impact zone. And it's really, you know, it to most people, it probably just looks like a giant open landscape. Mm-hmm. But to somebody who's a trained ecologist and biologist like myself, I see the plants and the animals that have to have prairie landscapes. And that's the only place left in a 100-mile radius mm-hmm. where they're still flourishing and living like they were two centuries ago.
Wow. So it's like looking back in time almost when you go to this area.
It's time travel. Absolutely. Yeah.
So this is something that you're passionate about. I mean, you've been called the prairie preacher. I hope that's still okay to refer to that.
Sure. Yeah.
So how did you end up, because you know, you and some other individuals helped started this Southeastern Grasslands Institute. How did you even get involved with this, find out about all this?
And that's a great question. I've always been a talker, as I'm sure that 15 minute story shows. But yeah, you know, as a professional biologist, mm-hmm. I spent the first 10 years of my career at Austin Peay really concerned about the plant diversity of Tennessee, you know, endangered species. And then as I became more and more aware of the kinds of things that myself and my students were researching and studying, I realized that a lot of the things I had been taught as a kid and as a high school student, or even as a college student, about the landscape of Tennessee and the eastern United States, they didn't hold up when I really started scrutinizing what we were finding with the scientific information. For example, I'd always been taught that the entire eastern United States was covered in forest, right? Well, the Walker Smith expedition clearly indicates we had a grassland 120 miles wide right there on the state line.
Wow.
But when I started looking at the rare plants and the rare animals that need to see what they need, mm-hmm. what it revealed is that about 66% of all the rare plants in Tennessee, that's like 440 species, 60% of all those need grasslands. And I thought, well, if everything was forested, then why are 60% of our endangered species needing something other than forest?
Yeah.
And that just clicked a light bulb in my mind. And I started really then studying grasslands. And the deeper I got into that, the more I realized, oh my gosh, there's this whole forgotten landscape, this forgotten Tennessee that's out there. Mm-hmm. That led me to becoming insanely interested in the study of American history and Tennessee history. And I dug into archives and I called elders and talked to them. I looked at ancient maps from, you know, the 1600s, 1700s, looked at Cherokee oral legends. And the more I put all this stuff together and I talked to my colleagues and co-founder Theo Witzel, we began to assemble a story that we found to be revolutionary, that has simply never been told in American history, in American conservation. And now we're telling that story. And we've embarked on a massive journey. And I'd say over the past 5 years, just speaking face-to-face to people, we've spoken to approaching 20,000 people face-to-face. So we're on a mission. And, sometimes we feel like an old-timey circuit preacher who's sort of just making the rounds, right, telling everybody about the gospel of grasslands.
And the importance of them, that these grasslands were originally here and they're an important part of our region, I guess, the whole southeastern region.
Yeah, it's important. It's important to our biodiversity, obviously, as a biologist, but it's important to us as people because, grasslands are really key to ecosystem services, helping to combat climate change, preventing topsoil erosion, keeping water clean in places like, the Red River. One reason why the Red River is so polluted today is because we've taken 90% of what should be in that watershed and we've converted it from grassland to something else. And so there's just massive amounts of fertilizers and agricultural, runoff and nitrates running into that river system. A lot of that wouldn't be getting in there if we had more of a sort of a protected buffer, against some of that from running into the streams. But also there's a lot of cultural connections to grasslands that people, I think, we've simply forgotten, that because we don't know as a society, we don't remember that grasslands were part of our early history. And that means they were part of the everyday living experience of Americans up until like 1850. Nobody in Clarksville in the past, 175 years has experienced grasslands. And so they've essentially been erased from our collective memory as Tennesseans.
Yeah. And the animals that live or would survive off the grasslands have all disappeared from this, or mostly disappeared, I'm assuming, or?
Absolutely. We lost bison certainly by the year 1800 in this region. So greater prairie chickens. If you drive up to around Cracker Barrel at exit 4 on Wilmer Rudolph Boulevard, just go a little bit past Cracker Barrel as you're going toward Kentucky. And just a couple hundred feet past Cracker Barrel, right across the road from Sam's Club and Tractor Supply.
Yeah.
Look on the left side of the road, and there's a historical marker that honors the elder Reuben Ross, for whom the Ross family connects to, like, Rossview High School.
Wow.
That family name is important because the Ross family came over in 1806 from North Carolina. They settled right there near where it is today, Google, and Oakland Elementary School off of Oakland Road. And they had a homestead there. And Reuben Ross was a circuit preacher, and he would ride all over the surrounding 50 square mile region preaching to people, and as he rode, he noted the landscape, and he talked about, for example, greater prairie chickens. He called them the prairie bird. This is the little bird that's about the size of a hen, but they only lived in prairies. And he wrote about them. And I've got an excellent quote. If you don't mind, I'd like to just recite. Reuben Ross said, "It would be difficult to imagine anything more beautiful. For as far as the eye could see, they seemed to be one vast deep green meadow. They were adorned with countless numbers of solitary trees springing up and countless numbers of bright flowers springing up in all directions. Now and then there was a solitary tree, maybe a post oak was to be seen. He said, it was here I first saw the prairie bird, or the barren hen, as we called it, which I afterwards met with in such vast numbers on the great prairies of Illinois. And here the wild strawberries grew in such profusion as to stain the horses' hooves a deep red color. This was about 1812 that he wrote that. But he lived right off of exit 4, and he documented species like the greater prairie chicken and down along the floodplain of Spring Creek, which flows through the Google Data Center property. He even noted the extinct Carolina parakeet, which disappeared about 100 years ago off the face of the planet. We don't even have them anymore. So, yeah, there's a lot of species that have declined or gone away. But some of those species, like northern harrier hawks and short-eared owls, northern bobwhite quail, grasshopper sparrows, they still remain at Fort Campbell in the grasslands there.
Oh.
So part of what we're working on is let's rebuild their habitat off base at places like the Google Data Center in Dunbar Cave and the Guthrie Prairie. And let's bring back this habitat that's part of our lost natural heritage and cultural heritage so these species can begin to make a rebound.
Yeah, so the Institute, the Southeastern Grasslands Institute, you're about educating, but you're more than that. You're actually working to help bring these back, to restore some of these lost habitats. And you mentioned Google and Dunbar Cave. Y'all have got projects there that y'all have developed over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think as an organization, you know, this obviously part of Austin Peay State University, we have education and outreach and research is at our core. That's a major part of what we do. I'd say it's the majority of what we do. Mm-hmm. But a few years ago, we decided that we had to do more. And I think we were all felt individually compelled to do more, right? It's a little bit underwhelming and unsatisfying to simply just do the research and see these ecosystems continue to vanish. And to continue to know that for my children and your children and for future generations, that they will simply disappear. And we have a higher calling to say, not on our watch, and to say, look, if we don't do this, no one else is going to do it. And so for that reason, we decided to really grow out our program to have a really vibrant and visible on the ground restoration component. That's a little bit unusual, I think, as a university to have, you know, people out there, you know, sowing prairies and removing invasive species and conducting prescribed fires and managing landscapes. It's a little bit more typical of, you know, nonprofits or like the Nature Conservancy, some state right. agencies and federal agencies. But those are really two critical aspects of our work, the research and outreach, plus the conservation work. And then in the future, we're also doing a lot to influence policy on grasslands from local to federal levels. And part of our aspirational goals is to develop a grant program. So we understand we can't do it all by ourselves. We want to be able to connect with the philanthropic community, with corporate sponsors, with major federal support to uplift the funding for grasslands all over the southeastern U.S. And so that's to do that requires pilot projects. And I'll stop here just to answer your question and say that, you know, projects like Dunbar Cave State Park Prairie, which is 15 acres, was our very first attempt to show that we could do that work. And then we moved into Google to do 50 acres. And now we've got our eyes set on 10,000 acres over the next 5 years.
Wow, that's amazing. And so just that work is kind of doing controlled burns, or maybe what does that work look like, I guess?
Yeah, so, you know, like at Google Prairie, for example, we let me just give the example actually from Dunbar. Dunbar now is probably in its seventh year of development. And so we raised the money to do the project. Mm-hmm. that fundraising component is really key to a lot of what we do. I'd say a huge component of our work is fundraising. And we were able to raise $35,000 from a Roundstone native seed up in Kentucky, who provided all the seed and the herbicide and the labor, and they came and planted it. And along the way, then our team, and of course, Dunbar Cave State Park, part of the Tennessee State Park system, their major contribution was to grant the land, right? They still own it, but they allowed us to use their land to do this project. And then the Friends of Dunbar Cave Group, which is the fundraising and support system for the state park, they've been instrumental in helping to provide additional funding and volunteerism. And then our role is to do things like the planning, writing the management plans, actually doing some of the management. So we go out there with our and recruit a volunteer team to go out and remove invasive species. We do a lot of the coordination work on the site. So if it needs to be burned, we help to coordinate that. If it needs to be mowed or cut hay off of it, we coordinate that. So we're very hands-on with Dunbar, and there's a trail system that goes through it too. So it's a community destination now. People can go there and hike it. And we're now working with the state parks to create a system of signs there, interpretive signs that tell people about the history of the project. That's just the starter. And we're now going to be doing, we're doing similar work now with Google. We've got projects in other cities in Chattanooga and Nashville. We're doing the same thing. We wanted to use Dunbar Cave as the proof of concept to grow this vision across our entire 24-state region. And I think we've really succeeded. And it's a great project with a lot of excitement. And it's more than just restoring habitat. Again, it's creating a destination for people to enjoy.
Wow, that's great. And I forgot 24-state region. I mean, this is a big area that we've got our eyes on. And then there's the Guthrie Prairie. Is that something that now does SGI, how does that fit into what you guys do? Is that something you oversee or own? Or I wasn't sure how that works.
So, yeah, that's a great question. So you're right. On just the past month or so, we as university announced that collaboratively we had purchased the Guthrie Prairie as a new 6-acre prairie preserve is what we kind of call it. And this is actually really well positioned for this discussion because it is on the Tennessee-Kentucky state line. It straddles the line. And so Thomas Walker and Daniel Smith and their band of 10 or 15 surveyors literally walked through the middle of this 6-acre Guthrie Prairie in 1779 as they laid out the state boundary. So we are interested in opening that up to the public. We were able to purchase that collaboratively thanks to the private fundraising efforts that SGI has been doing. We raised $104,000 from a single donor to purchase that site. It's a remnant prairie, sort of like the Fort Campbell Impact Zone. Mm-hmm. It has lasted and endured through 300 years of change. Of landscape change. And it's the last little scrap of its kind. And it's beautiful, Charles. It's got like 5,000 tall green milkweeds in it, which is a disappearing species of beautiful sort of whitish green flowers. And it's an important site for butterflies and pollinators. And it's located right at the edge of the city of Guthrie, which, of course, most people associate with Kentucky. Mm-hmm. But, Guthrie is a town, fairly low income and not a lot of opportunity. This creates a natural area right on the edge of town that eventually we'll be able to open this up to the public with signs and a trail system. And I got to imagine that there will be a kid in Guthrie, many kids. There will be retirees and elderly people or just curious people who will be able to go there for enjoyment and recreation, but they'll be able to go there in times of need to give them connection to nature that they simply don't have right now in their little town. And, people from our university, our students and our professors like Dr. Katie Haas and Dr. Evan Rehm and others can go there and conduct research. And it can be places we take our classes. That's, that model of purchasing these sites is something, again, a lot of people don't think about that being typical for a university. But right. we raised another $50,000 last month from a different donor. And we call it our Robert C. and Deborah B. Hulse Prairie Acquisition Fund. And we are going to be purchasing other sites in the future that people in other communities across Tennessee can enjoy and go to for education and outreach.
Oh, wow. So we're going to be protecting sort of these forgotten Tennessee sites, you know, the original Tennessee. Well, that's great. Well, Dr. Estes, that's just kind of, y'all been doing this for 5 years officially. I know you've been working on this much longer. And then I guess the future, you're excited about the future, these possible maybe grant programs helping protect all these imperiled areas.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's, we started out as just sort of a two-person operation. It was myself and my co-founder, Theo Witzel, who's based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And from there, we rapidly, you know, through the university, grew with support. We hired an administrative assistant, and I brought on my team of graduate students who played various roles. And then the more funding we got, and the Band Foundation out of Washington, D.C. has been our primary funders since the start. They've, to date, over the 5 years, they've given us around $1.75 million to grow this program. And it was they who first encouraged us to grow a program. Mm-hmm. I would have never done it on my own. I had no ability to think that big. But when a philanthropic foundation comes to you and says, guys, you're on to something special. You know, we've heard your prairie preaching. We believe in you. We want you to do something major. We want you to grow a program, and we'll help you. And so with their philanthropic backing, it has allowed us to attract numerous other foundations. Just yesterday, I'm excited to report, we just received almost $250,000 in funding, brand new money. Wow. That we didn't expect from two additional private philanthropic foundations. You know, our work with Google continues to escalate. Just one aspect of our program, just our seed program alone, we brought in about $1 million over the past, you know, 1.5 years from federal funding sources. We're currently on track to probably get somewhere around $2.5 to $2.7 million funds raised just this year. With about a $7 million fundraising track record since we began. I only talk about money, Charles, because it's vital to what we do. And because of people who believe in Austin Peay State University, they believe in the mission we're doing, their money is going to support some excellent causes like restoring and protecting landscapes, research, internships, and scholarships for students. I really believe the sky's the limit. Next year on my horizon, I've got a number of planned trips to Washington, D.C. to meet with most of the major federal agencies, with planned visits to Capitol Hill to advocate on behalf of more grassland funding and to meet with some foundations. So I think as we continue to work collaboratively with our university here and with our partners across the East, I really think that we're on to some good things, to be honest with you.
Well, that's great. And so if people are curious about more, they can go to the website. Is that
Yeah, check out the website. It's segrasslands.org. And again, we're a lot of content there if you want to know more. And feel free to, I think there's a couple links particularly to point people to. If you're interested in volunteering and participating in any of our work days, excuse me, you can sign up to become a volunteer. If you want to receive our newsletter, you can sign up to receive that as well. And by all means, if anybody is interested in donating, you can see that link there under the Take Action link in the upper right. You can see that, and we appreciate the donations, small or large, to help support the good work that we're trying to accomplish.
Well, yeah. Well, Dr. Estes, I really appreciate you joining us today and kind of sharing this whole lost, forgotten Tennessee story with us. And I really do appreciate the work you guys are doing with SGI. And just thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate it. I was a little scared my voice wasn't going to hold. I talked for 14 hours yesterday. So hopefully it came through just fine. And I appreciate your time very much. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Great. Well, once again, thank you so much. And I appreciate it.
Thanks, Charles.
Thanks.